Let's talk about the state of democracy. Senator Vance, you have said you would not have certified the last presidential election and would have asked the states to submit alternative electors. That has been called unconstitutional and illegal. Would you again seek to challenge this year's election results, even if every governor certifies the results? I'll give you 2 minutes.
Well, Nora, first of all, I think that we're focused on the future. We need to figure out how to solve the inflation crisis caused by Kamala Harris's policies. It's really rich for Democratic leaders to say that Donald Trump is a unique threat to democracy when he peacefully gave over power on January the 20th.
This is one that we are miles apart on. This was a threat to our democracy in a way that we had not seen. And it manifested itself because of Donald Trump's inability to say. He is still saying he didn't lose the election. I would just ask that. Did he lose the 2020 election?
Tim, I'm focused on the future. Did Kamala Harris censor Americans from speaking their mind in the wake of the 2020 COVID situation?
No. No, she did not. So there's the answer to that one. Now, JD, you want to answer that other question?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
I didn't think so.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's Queso and Eugene's KEPW, in Lanchester, Pennsylvania on W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, and Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com with special coverage today. And all I can say today really is a what? No zingers, no brutal one-liners, no insults or nicknames. What kind of a debate was that? I want my money back. It was the first presidential ticket debate in years, including primary debates, where candidates actually focused on actual substance. Now, that was for good or ill, and both with and without a whole bunch of lies. But they did so instead of simply attacking their opponents. It has left me and clearly much of the broadcast media right afterward, after that debate on Tuesday night, not sure how to actually cover it. We're just not all that used to dealing with things, you know, with actual substance anymore, it seems to me. Again, even if much of that substance is made up prevarications, rewritten history, and nonsense. But the vice presidential debate on Tuesday night in New York City was apparently the final debate of the 2024 election season between the Harris Walls and Trump-Vance tickets, because Trump flatly refuses to debate again after the drubbing that he took in his first outing with Kamala Harris back in early September. But with pre-election polling averages suggesting a virtually tied race, well, if you thought the vice presidential debate might offer clarity or open things up one way or another, well, you might be disappointed. At least according to the snap polls taken among debate watchers immediately afterward on Tuesday night. According to CNN's instant poll of those who actually watched it, Republican Senator J.D. Vance won the debate against Minnesota Governor Tim Walz by the slightest of margins, 51% of respondents said that Vance came out on top, compared to 49% who said the same of Walz. A 2-point margin in a poll with a more than 5-point margin of error. Of course, that's just one poll, but another post-debate flash poll, this one from CBS News, which hosted the debate, found Vance winning by an even slimmer margin over Walz, 42% to 41%. If it's any help, both candidates also improved their overall approval ratings in those instant polls by a lot, in fact. According to CNN's instant poll, Vance improved on his pre-debate favorability, which was at an all-time low for a modern vice presidential candidate, by 19 points. But Walz improved his rating by 23 points, and that may prove to be better news than you think, because the wildly unpopular Vance was actually 22 points underwater among respondents in CNN's poll before the debate on favorability, before improving to -3 by the time the debate was over. Walz, on the other hand, began the debate with a +14 approval rating. After the debate, he was +37 on favorability. That seems helpful for the Harris-Walz ticket. On the other hand, that CBS YouGov snap poll asked debate watchers whether they thought the tone of the debate was negative or positive, and nearly 9 in 10 said that it was generally positive, which is a sharp reversal from previous presidential-level debates, when, particularly when Donald Trump was on the stage. So maybe there was that. Watching it was less likely to drive Americans to want to jump off a bridge than pretty much any debate we've seen over the last nearly 10 years. So good news? That must be worth something. Perhaps Vance's shape-shifting from a far-right, very online MAGA incel to a 1990s somewhat congenial Republican allowed him to undercut the biting weird characterizations that have dogged the Trump-Vance ticket. I don't know. Perhaps Vance ate that dog on Tuesday night. Perhaps my guest joining us momentarily will have some wisdom in this regard. As AP described it, in a debate that evoked a calmer era in American politics, Tim Walz and J.D. Vance on Tuesday went after each other's running mates and sought to shore up their campaign's vulnerabilities at a time of renewed fears of a regional war in the Middle East and sadness over devastation from Hurricane Helene. But both Walz and Vance focused many of their criticisms on the top of the ticket, as is traditional for vice presidential debates. Vance, a graduate of Yale Law School, also used his considerable debating skills to try and soften his image and that of Trump's, ratcheting down his typically aggressive delivery and acknowledging that people watching might not agree with him or Trump, as he smoothed over much of Trump's bombastic, often incoherent rhetoric. In fact, successfully sane-washing much of Trump's bitter, divisive, often utterly nonsensical ideology and his constant flip-flops, for example, on things like abortion, to say whatever the crowd he's speaking to might, you know, most want to hear. Vance avoided largely being pinned down on the more controversial parts of the former president's record, or of his own, such as referring to Trump as America's Hitler and deriding the failure of Trump's economic policies as late as 2020. That, according to recent text messages from J.D. Vance, unearthed by the Washington Post last week. Walz, for his part, who was notably nervous in the early part of the debate, I thought, depicted Trump as wrong on the issues, a chaotic leader, even as he occasionally fumbled with his own words early on in the debate before finding his groove as the 90-minute face-off wore on, if he remained Minnesota nice from beginning to end. About a third of the way into the vice presidential debate, the discussion turned to Springfield, Ohio, the community torn apart by a racist and false conspiracy theory promoted by both members of the Republican Party ticket. It was against this backdrop, MSNBC's Steve Bannon observed, that Senator J.D. Vance, who ostensibly represents the city as Ohio's senator, referred to, quote, millions of illegal immigrants in parts of the country that have been, quote, destroyed by Kamala Harris's open border. But as Bennin notes, Vance was peddling a multi-layered lie with those remarks. The border isn't open. The vice president isn't responsible for the nation's immigration laws, and Springfield's Haitian immigrants entered the country legally. Indeed, Governor Walz took the opportunity to note that his rival had, quote, vilified a large number of people who were here legally. At that point, one of the debate's moderators, CBS News' Margaret Brennan, told viewers, quote, to clarify for our viewers, Springfield, Ohio does have a large number of Haitian migrants who have legal status, temporary protected status. But the GOP nominee was not having it. The New York Times referred to it as the debate's fact-checking flashpoint because Vance objected to the fact check, speaking over the moderators and preventing them from asking their next question, complaining at one point, quote, Margaret, the rules were that you guys weren't going to fact check. In reality, even that wasn't true. As the New York Times report noted, CBS News executives had indicated ahead of the event that the moderators may choose to clarify a fuzzy point if they determined it had been left unclear. Or, put another way, Vance lied about fact-checking after having lied about immigration policy. The Ohio Republican wasn't upset because the debate moderators were wrong. He was upset because the debate moderators were telling the public the truth. The GOP nominee also lied about Trump and the Affordable Care Act, claiming that Trump, and I quote, saved Obamacare. He lied about his earlier support for a national abortion ban, claiming that he never supported one when he repeatedly said that he did. He lied about his party's regressive 2017 tax breaks for corporations and the wealthy, and he lied, among other things, about the, quote, peaceful transfer of power after Trump's 2020 defeat, claiming that Trump left office peacefully on January 20th, 2021, as if January 6th, 2021 never even happened, resulting in one of Tim Walz's best moments of the night, and perhaps the one that will overshadow pretty much everything else on Tuesday night.
It's really rich for Democratic leaders to say that Donald Trump is a unique threat to democracy when he peacefully gave over power on January the 20th. But we have to remember that for years in this country, Democrats protested the results of elections.
This is one that we are miles apart on. This was a threat to our democracy in a way that we had not seen. And it manifested itself because of Donald Trump's inability to say. He is still saying he didn't lose the election. I would just ask that. Did he lose the 2020 election?
Tim, I'm focused on the future. Did Kamala Harris censor Americans from speaking their mind in the wake of the 2020 COVID situation?
That is a damning non-answer.
It's a damning non-answer for you to not talk about censorship. The most sacred right under the United States democracy is the First Amendment. Kamala Harris wants to use the power of government and big tech to silence people from speaking their minds.
You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. That's the test. That's the Supreme Court test.
Tim, fire in a crowded theater. You guys wanted to kick people off of Facebook.
He lost the election. This is not a debate other than in Donald Trump's world. When Mike Pence made that decision to certify that election, that's why Mike Pence isn't on this stage. What I'm concerned about is, where is the firewall with Donald Trump? Where is the firewall if he knows he could do anything, including taking an election, and his vice president's not going to stand to it? That's what we're asking you, America. Will you keep your oath of office, even if the president doesn't? So, America, I think you've got a really clear choice on this election of who's going to honor that democracy and who's going to honor Donald Trump.
Well, joining us now to try and help us make sense of all the damning non-answers and others from Tuesday night, New York City, are, of course, Desi Doyen, who's been up all night pulling clips that I'll probably never have time to play. Good day, Desi.
Hello.
And our 2024 post-debate champion roundtablers and fellow old-school bloggers, Heather Digby Parton, often known simply as Digby, of both Salon and her own long-running Hullabaloo blog, and the man known largely as simply Driftglass, though occasionally as Bill or even Mr. Electrico on Twitter. He is both a longtime politically active liberal blogger and co-host with his wife and our friend Fran, or Blue Gal, take your pick, of the weekly Professional Left podcast produced from their home in what they lovingly describe as Flyover Country, Illinois. Hey, guys, welcome back to the broadcast.
Glad to be here.
Hello.
Hello. All right. Driftglass, this is. I'm going to start with you. Heads up, because I know that throws you off. But I'm going to start with you. Many argue that vice presidential debates don't actually matter in presidential contests. So, despite planning to discuss exactly that for the bulk of this hour, let me go ahead and undermine my own premise first by asking right off the bat, Driftglass, do vice presidential debates matter? Specifically, does this vice presidential debate matter as you see it? And in a broad sense, what did you make of it overall?
Well, the debate was last night, right?
Yeah, something like that.
You see, Brad, I'm focused on the future. I'm
see.
Not focused on what happened yesterday or a year ago or
yeah.
5 years ago.
I see.
It's not a debate. Look, as a high school debater, let me tell you right off the bat, this isn't a debate. This is two guys talking. They talked a little bit of policy. That's great. But this was each campaign trying to execute a strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't aimed at me. So, you know, I don't speak Italian. So when I go to an opera and they're yelling in Italian, I don't complain that they're not speaking English.
Uh-huh.
It's not aimed at me. My question is, did J.D. Vance accomplish what the Trump campaign wanted him to do? The answer is probably yeah. Did Tim Walz accomplish what the Harris campaign wanted him to do? Probably yeah, because he wasn't aiming at me. He was aiming at the undecided middle class, middle America, I'm not sure who's who voter. To that extent, this was successful because it created advertising moments. That is all that anyone is going to use this for anyway.
Mm-hmm.
This is the Ali Foreman fight. Yeah, it was tied up until the eighth round, and then Ali killed him. Right up until the subject of the 2020 election came up, there were a bunch of lies, the ACA lies and so forth, but right up until that. But that's the moment. That's the thing. That's the thing that fans can never take back, and they can never pretend it didn't happen, and it's going to be spun up into ads by tomorrow if it hasn't already. So to that extent, as an advertising moment creation machine, it did what it was supposed to do.
Wow. The Ali Foreman fight. You are older than I even thought, but well done. Heather, you wrote at Salon today on the, quote, agreeable and collegial nature of the debate. It was a bit over the top from both men, for your taste, you wrote, and that Vance has all the charm and warmth of a king cobra. Well, that does not seem very Midwestern nice of you, but didn't Vance's sane washing of both his running mate and himself succeed, as Driftglass suggests, in delivering what Trump needs to in order to reach the, well, whoever are the last of the undecided folks out there?
Well, first of all, I am not Midwestern nice. I'm from California.
I know.
We're not nice.
I know.
So just to make that clear, yeah, the King Cobra, I agree with everything that Driftglass said. I think that they accomplished what they set out to do. Both of them were apparently, aside from, you know, Vance needed to soften all the, you know, ridiculous extremist policies of himself and Donald Trump, and present himself as something less than a full-blown King Cobra in full, you know, flower up there, which I think he managed to do. He sounded semi-sane. I mean, I'm sure most people who hadn't been following him probably thought, well, you know, it's not that bad. And Walz, you know, just needed to go out there and, you know, present himself as the nice guy that the campaign wants him to be seen as, a nice white Midwestern man, to offset, you know, the crazy California prosecutor at the top of the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, that and you know, you can see the difference between the two. And that's all it is. I mean, I think they accomplished what they set out to do. As far as the niceness thing, I think when you look at the snap polls, and I think they're probably going to bear out, they're going to be borne out when you see some polls done down the road. You know, mm-hmm. it takes a few days to really percolate. But they all showed, as you pointed out in your opening, that their favorabilities went up, both of them, for mm-hmm. being, you know, just because they were civil to one another.
It was like a debate from the 1990s or something.
Yeah. And Donald Trump wasn't there being a jackass. You know, I mean, that's really all there is to it. You know, no Donald Trump, and people were relatively normal mm-hmm. in that. And people liked that. They liked it about both of them. Now, one of the things you have to point out, their favorabilities both went up, but Walz's started out much higher and really went through the roof.
Yeah.
I mean, he ended up with 60% mm-hmm. favorable in at least one of the polls. I think it was the CBS poll. And Vance went up too. He went from like 42 to 49%. So mm-hmm. for him, you know, big improvement.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I think that both campaigns kind of succeeded in doing something, which was kind of just, you know, we've all talked about toning down the rhetoric and being, you know, not being so mean and what have you. Just wanted to, I think that certainly on the Republican side, you know, with Donald Trump acting like an absolute lunatic these days on the stump, that, you know, this was something that they were hoping to do, to try to create the sense that this isn't a completely, you know, abnormal kind of election where everybody's got to be so upset and stressed out. It isn't a normal election, and we all need to be stressed out. So I don't know how much that really helps in terms of the Democrats. Mm-hmm. But I think what they really wanted to do was to present Tim Walz as, you know, here's your guy. He's exactly what we said he was. Cool guy, very nice, got a lot of, you know, warmth and good humor, and people seem to like that. I mean, as I said in my piece, I wasn't all that, you know, thrilled. I kind of, you know, I like the combativeness. I kind of wanted to see Walz, you know, I said to my husband when I was watching it, what if he just walked over and just, you know, hit him in the face. What if we just did that? You know, would we cheer? And we both agreed that we probably would. That's my perspective on it.
Driftglass, TPM's Josh Marshall wrote last night, quote, "It drove me crazy that Walz spent half his time saying Vance was probably a good guy and they could probably agree on a lot. Drove me crazy," says Josh. "It drove me nuts that Walz didn't swing hard at some of the hanging curveballs that Vance threw over the plate. He concedes that he finally did on democracy before writing, but I'm not the audience for this stuff. I think the avuncular nice guy thing probably worked for him." Talking about Vance here. I'm sorry, talking about Walz here, probably worked for him and with the people who matter, not my cup of tea, but I'm not the average voter. So, Driftglass, you, like me, are also from the Midwest, but you, unlike me, defy that whole Midwest nice thing. So, did it work for those voters who matter for Tim Walz to not actually, you know, walk across the stage and punch Vance in the face?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this is clearly they're executing a strategy. And the strategy was, Tim Walz, you're a nice guy. Everybody thinks you're a nice guy. You got to read the briefing book. You got to know all the facts. And that's, I think, what threw him off. It kind of constrained him to stick to the talking points that they wanted him to stick to. But the whole idea of this debate, I wanted to see him come out there with a sword in both hands and just scream liar for like 90 minutes.
Yes, me too.
And you know what? He would have definitely gotten my vote, but he's got it already. He doesn't need my vote. What he needs is, I think, tactically, to go out there and be the nicest guy you've ever met in your life and just very agreeable and so like regretful that he has to disagree. You know, JD, you and I got to disagree on this. You know how much I think of you. But and he's got it. That guy is the guy that people around here are delighted to have as their mayor or their city councilor. That's who they want to see at the front of the stage.
Or the governor of Minnesota.
Exactly. And he exuded not just Midwest nice vibes, but governor vibes. He knew his stuff at Minnesota. How many times if I had Minnesota on my drink chart, right, I'd be unconscious by 8:30 because every example he cited was from Minnesota. You know, up in Minnesota, we did this and that. And it, for me, he doesn't need me, like I said, but I think for the people he's striving to reach, it worked. because they wanted the 90s back, wanted this sort of thing back. And he's, you know, he's doing a great job supporting Kamala Harris. Vance has the reverse problem. Trump is praying Vance has coattails because everybody hates Donald Trump. So you've got to polish up the turd that you put on your ticket to make him appear like a human being so that he can go out there and be the nice guy. And I suppose he succeeded. But I think Walz did a fine job. I was definitely upset that he didn't, you know, swing at every one of those curveballs that you mentioned.
Yeah.
You know, you're a liar. You're lying about the ACA. You're lying about immigrants. You're lying. But that's not him, and that's not the strategy they wanted to execute. So,
one place that I thought that Vance was actually very successful, and that Walz, I don't want to say inability, but you know, decision to not punch back, but where you know he really failed to respond, as I saw it, was that Vance was able to sort of successfully turn Kamala Harris into the current president.
Yes,
even though she is not. You know, claiming that every single Biden policy was actually her policy and that she decided not to do all the things that she's calling for, like the $6,000 tax credits for families with newborns, $25,000 off down payments for first time home buyers, all of that. And Vance was like, well, why, you know, why didn't she do that when she had the chance? Well, she was not the president. And by the way, it would have needed, you know, to work with Congress and everything to do most of those things. Walz never pushed back on that rhetorical trick of Vance's, Heather.
Well, I mean, maybe that I noticed that too. And I thought, but what would, if he'd have said, well, she wasn't the president, you know, she's only the vice president or something, that kind of diminishes her in a way. I think they anticipated this. And just decided to let it go. Because I think if, you know, most of us listening to that, in fact, we even said it as we're watching the thing going, you know, she's the VP. What do you mean she didn't sign, you know, an executive order?
Exactly.
Didn't, you know, pass? I mean, and I don't think that we're the only ones who were kind of going, what? Well, you know, what's he talking about? So I think that was a strategic decision myself.
We will
to let it go.
We'll come back and hit some of the specifics from the debate. Again, not used to it. But there were a lot of, you know, substantive exchanges between the people. So we'll try to hit some of those. But before a quick break here, actually real quick from both of you, Driftglass, let me start with you. How'd the moderators do? The CBS Evening News' Nora O'Donnell and Face the Nation's Margaret Brennan. How did they do? And I'm going to not give you my thoughts, but ask for yours.
They did okay. They could have done better. I appreciated the fact that they did stop, cut the mic eventually on J.D. Vance, explain to him that he was not telling the truth, and then move on. I was hoping for a lot more of that. I was hoping they would break free from any constraints. And when the ACA thing, I have a big thing about that. The ACA was just a flat out complete lie. And it would have taken 10 seconds to say the ACA was attempted to be overturned 60 times by Donald Trump. They had a beer party at the Rose Garden celebrating it. None of what you just said is true.
Yeah.
But, you know, they did okay. They did better than the CNN debate, and they acquitted themselves well.
Heather, your thoughts on O'Donnell and Brennan on Tuesday night?
I agree with that. And once they sort of broke that barrier of saying, you know, and admitting that they did have the power, whatever that means, to do some fact-checking, I was kind of hoping that they would do more. And the ACA thing drove me nuts, too. And it also bothered me the way they framed some of the questions.
Yes.
One in particular, you know, asking Tim Walz to answer for this ridiculous and disgusting accusation that he and other Democrats believe in executing babies after birth, and framing it in this, you know, and what do you have to say to that, Governor Walz? And it's just, you know, come on, don't put that out there. I mean, I just think that's ridiculous. And so I think there was definitely some framing issues. A lot of that, you know, we've seen this through this entire campaign, and I guess we see it in every campaign, where it's always you have to answer for the ridiculous accusations of the other side. I just don't like that.
I don't either, and I'll just respond to both of you guys by saying you're both wrong, because I thought they were atrocious. I thought they were the worst of the moderators we've seen this cycle. And, you know, and the reason is, you know, they clearly wanted to ask a lot about issues. And, you know, they needed to get out of the way instead of that and let the two debate. Yes, they hit a lot of issues, but I think for many folks, issues are not the issue. Character is the issue. And frankly, I don't think they pressed either of the candidates, but particularly J.D. Vance, or as Desi likes to call him, Shady J.D., on his... on his slurs against women, his failure to support allies like Ukraine around the world, his admission that, you know, he would have helped Trump steal the election, last election, and so forth. They didn't press him on that issue. And then it seemed
childless
like
cat ladies. They never said anything.
Never
about
said
them.
That. Exactly. And when they wanted to go at each other, they kept jumping in with, no, we got to get to the next issue. We've got to talk about taxes. We got to talk about this or that. I don't know. We ended up with a very nice and congenial debate. But
that was also laden with a bunch of lies that did not get countered.
And I'm just not sure that America yet wants a nice, congenial debate. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back with some actual, yes, issues from the debate. That's straight ahead on the broadcast with our special coverage of the first, last, and only vice presidential debate of the year with Heather Digby Parton of Salon, Driftglass of the Pro Left podcast, and of course, Desi and me. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is the Bradcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Just to clarify for our viewers, Springfield, Ohio does have a large number of Haitian migrants who have legal status.
Margaret, I think it's important because the rules were that you guys weren't going to fact check. And since you're fact checking me, by
thank
our
you,
own
Senator,
leadership,
for describing the legal
and
process.
And
we
and
have
Kamala
so much
Harris
to get to, Senator.
Since 1990.
It's something that Kamala Harris created, Margaret.
Gentlemen, the audience can't hear you because your mics are cut.
No need to ask, he's a smooth operator.
J.D. Vance was pretty smooth on Tuesday night in that debate. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com with our special coverage with Heather Digby Parton of Salon, Driftglass of Pro Left Podcast, and of course, Desi Doyen and myself. All right. For the first time, I think, in ever, climate change actually came up in a presidential or vice presidential debate as the second question, instead of either not at all or the, you know, sort of the last question of the night. Well, because of that, we get to discuss the responses early-ish in our own coverage. And I want to give Desi Doyen a first crack at ringing in on this one. It came up early in the debate, I think, thanks to the monster, deadly, climate change-fueled Hurricane Helene, which has devastated residents of about 6 states, killing more than 130 people so far in a Category 4 storm that was exacerbated by record warm waters in the Gulf of Mexico, thanks to the man-made burning of fossil fuels, exactly as climate scientists have warned about for decades now. Here's how J.D. Vance decided to answer to the question about the dangers of climate change causing carbon buildup in our atmosphere.
We want the environment to be cleaner and safer. But one of the things that I've noticed some of our Democratic friends talking a lot about is a concern about carbon emissions, this idea that carbon emissions drives all of the climate change. Well, let's just say that's true, just for the sake of argument, so we're not arguing about weird science. Let's just say that's true. Well, if you believe that, what would you want to do? The answer is that you'd want to reshore as much American manufacturing as possible, and you'd want to produce as much energy as possible in the United States of America because we're the cleanest economy in the entire world. What have Kamala Harris's policies actually led to? More energy production in China, more manufacturing overseas, more doing business in some of the dirtiest parts of the entire world. And when I say that, I mean the amount of carbon emissions they're doing per unit of economic output. So if we actually care about getting cleaner air and cleaner water, the best thing to do is to double down and invest in American workers and the American people. And unfortunately, Kamala Harris has done exactly the opposite.
Okay, so let's just say that's true. That weird science about carbon emissions causing climate change. Desi Doyen, aren't we already producing as much energy, both renewable and dirty fossil fuels here at home? Aren't we already producing as much as possible? Have we already doubled down on all of that? And how
yes.
does that help climate change?
Well, first of all, it is great to hear J.D. Vance supporting the policies of the Biden-Harris administration because, yes, the U.S. Is now the biggest producer in the world of oil and gas, and we have a booming clean energy sector that is now producing more energy than it ever has before and is displacing coal. So, you know, a lot of the stuff, of course, that Vance said was just absolute nonsense. He used to accept climate science, and now he pretends that there is no global scientific consensus about CO2 emissions being the primary cause of climate change. So that was really surprising and disappointing to hear him say that. He also
surprising? Really? Was it surprising?
Well, I was surprised that he would come flat out and just deny it instead of saying, you know, for example, just moving on and pivoting to something else. So he also said that he and Trump want the environment to be cleaner and safer. But, you know, we actually have Trump's record to look at. Trump rolled back or eliminated nearly 100 clean air, water and climate rules. And studies found that air and water pollution actually increased during the Trump administration. Vance also falsely claimed that the U.S. is the cleanest economy in the entire world, and that is absolutely false. Actually, 15 other countries have cleaner air than the United States, and 25 countries have cleaner water.
Did Walls effectively rebut those claims?
He did okay. There was a lot of missed opportunities that Walls had, which I was, you know, somewhat disappointed to find because, of course, you know, the Biden administration passed the Inflation Reduction Act. He did refer to it, and he did refer to the Inflation Reduction Act and other legislation passed in the Biden-Harris administration in Congress when there was Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate. Those laws have actually reshored manufacturing. But, you know, unfortunately, I don't think he really punched back quite as much. There was such a litany of lies that Vance just laid out that it would have been impossible for anybody to really keep up with all of them. But I think Vance did an okay job on that. And he did.
Walls did,
yes,
an okay job.
Walls did, yeah, an okay job on countering that. There was a lot more that was missed in that he could have done. But at least Walls did accurately note that Donald Trump calls climate change a hoax.
And it came up right at the top of the debate, Desi Doyen.
Yeah, I was glad to see that.
Your
but
work
I was
here is done.
A bit disappointed, however, that Nora O'Donnell, she focused only on adapting to climate change, you know, the impacts of climate change. And she didn't say anything about what causes climate change. She didn't refer to the fact that it's caused by burning fossil fuels.
Let me tee one up here for Driftglass. J.D. Vance actually had the temerity, you referenced this a bit in our previous segment, but the temerity to claim that Donald Trump saved the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare in some imaginary bipartisan way, despite having tried to kill it, as you said, over and over again, 60 times or something like that throughout his presidency. Mm-hmm. Here's a little bit of his remarks there.
Donald Trump could have destroyed the program. Instead, he worked in a bipartisan way to ensure that Americans had access to affordable care. I think that Donald Trump has earned the right to put in place some better health care policies. He's earned it because he did it successfully the first time.
Governor?
All right, here's where being an old guy gives you some history. I was there at the creation of the ACA. And the reason it was so important is I come from a major healthcare state. We understand healthcare. It's why we're ranked first on affordability and accessibility and quality of healthcare. And so what I know is under Kamala Harris, more people are covered than they have before. And those of you listening, this is critical to you. Now, Donald Trump, he ran on the first thing he was going to do on day one was to repeal Obamacare. On day one, he tried to sign an executive order to repeal the ACA. He signed on to a lawsuit to repeal the ACA, but lost at the Supreme Court. And he would have repealed the ACA had it not been for the courage of John McCain to save that bill.
So, Driftglass, was Vance saying there, smooth operator as he is, that Trump saved Obamacare because he did not kill Obamacare when he could have, perhaps by strangling it administratively or something like that?
Yes, he's taking credit for failing to kill the Affordable Care Act as an act of mercy. He's like Good Samaritan.
So he saved Obamacare. You're finally admitting Vance is saying. I see.
He gave it a pardon. He likes that.
He did. He gave it a pardon. Uh-huh. He ran on putting together the greatest health insurance package you've ever seen. Cost pennies. It'd be so easy. You wouldn't believe how easy it's going to be. It's going to be so fast. And I know more about healthcare than anyone. And he had 4 years to do that. He failed every time. He made the same promise again after he was leaving office. He spent his entire administration running on the platform of killing the Affordable Care Act. All that is a matter of historical record. And this whole conversation got started when when J.D. Vance had to explain what Trump meant by a concept of a plan. What's a concept of a plan?
Yes.
A theory of a theory. And so that's where Vance did his job, which was just lie. Right across the board, this was a festival of whataboutism and lying. Mm. Every time anyone pointed out that, you know, he's lying about something, well, what about Kamala Harris? She locks people up for no good reason. What about the censorship? Mm. And, you know, in as a high school debater, you know, the one thing that will get you disqualified and your school suspended is lying. Mm. And that's the one thing that they absolutely permit, and there's no punishment for it at all at the presidential level.
Vance was also seeming to take credit for he did a lot of whataboutisms, as you said, and you know, suggesting, well, Kamala Harris are the ones who are the real threats to democracy. Kamala Harris are the real threats to women. Now, the January 6th stuff has gotten a lot of the attention following the debate. But I thought Tim Walz was very effective both in his remarks there about health care and in his comments on abortion rights. Obviously, one of the biggest issues in the campaign following Trump's Supreme Court overturning 50 years of freedoms from Roe v. Wade, such as in this comment.
Look, Donald Trump put this all into motion. He brags about how great it was that he put the judges in and overturned Roe versus Wade, 52 years of personal autonomy. And then he tells us, oh, we send it to the states. It's a beautiful thing. Amanda Zaworski would disagree with you on it's a beautiful thing. A young bride in Texas waiting for their child at 18 weeks, she has a complication, a tear in the membrane. The medical care at that point needs to be decided by the doctor. And that would have been an abortion. But in Texas, that would have put them in legal jeopardy. She went home, got sepsis, nearly dies, and now she may have difficulty having children. Or in Kentucky, Hadley Duvall, a 12-year-old child raped and impregnated by her stepfather. Those are horrific. Now, when got asked about that, Senator Vance said, two wrongs don't make a right. There is no right in this. So in Minnesota, what we did was restore Roe versus Wade. We made sure that we put women in charge of their health care. Their Project 2025, it's going to make it more difficult, if not impossible, to get contraception and limit access, if not eliminate access to infertility treatments. And the catch-all on this is, well, the states will decide what's right for Texas might not be right for Washington. That's not how this works. This is about health care. We trust women. We trust doctors.
I thought that was very effective, Heather. Now, Vance tried to turn that around, like I said, as he did throughout the night, saying, oh, it's Kamala Harris is the real threat to women's rights. Donald Trump is the protector of them. But I got to tell you, having watched that segment a couple of times, I'm still not sure, you know, what argument that Vance was making to that effect. I don't think I understood his response. Did you?
No, it was his worst response of the night. It was really bad. I mean, he first of all goes off into some, you know, soliloquy about him growing up in a working class family and knowing a young woman who had an abortion. And then years later, he talks to her and she said it was you know, it her life would have been destroyed if she hadn't had it, because she had was in an abusive relationship.
Which seems to be an argument. Seems to be an argument in
favor.
Going,
oh my God.
Yeah.
Vance has totally changed. Isn't this great? We're in a consensus.
And
but
that's
of course,
the point.
That's not. Yeah, of course. And people are going, oh, isn't that reasonable? Listen, if he's so compassionate, you know. Well, the truth is this is the most uncompassionate guy there is on this issue. And he did have to say, and I think this is where he really messed up in this answer, was that, you know, what he was trying to say is, well, she was in an abusive relationship, and what we really need to do is protect women from abusive relationships. We need to protect women from this, protect women from that, et cetera, from all the things, and give them the support they need to raise more babies. Or as Donald Trump said the other day, we need more babies. You know? So, which is basically what J.D. Vance, that's the, you know, the fundamental belief system that he's operating from. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what he said, and he said it more than once, was this thing, Republicans have got to do a much better job of earning the American people's trust back on this issue, where they frankly don't trust us. Well, guess why?
Yeah.
No, we don't trust you because you reversed Roe versus Wade. And, you know, now we have this horrible, you know, patchwork of fundamental rights all over the country, and women are dying and people are suffering, and, you know, the maternal health is in danger in all these places. And of course they don't trust the Republicans. And him saying that we've got to do a better job. Well, there's only one way to do that, dude. Think about it. What do you need to do to restore the trust of the American people? You need to restore Roe versus Wade. And, you know, obviously they're not going
to
do that.
Yeah, you have to stop being fundamentalist nuts about, you know, about women's rights to their own bodies. You know, and I think that was the target of Vance in the debate, as you guys were saying, to sane-wash and soften the insane policies of Republicans that are, you know, like when Vance says that they want Americans to trust us again, I was really disturbed that a CNN focus group woman said that she was surprised to hear that Vance's opinion on abortion actually was pretty reasonable, and she was really encouraged by that. Yes, I was really disturbed and saddened by that, because Vance is a sociopathic liar, and it was working. It worked.
Not to mention, if he's concerned about abusive relationships that, you know, his friend was in, isn't he against no-fault divorce?
Yes, he is against it.
Allowing women
He's the one who said that, right? That women should stay in abusive relationships for the sake of the kids.
Yep,
he said it.
All right, the issue of school shootings and the GOP's years of advocacy against wildly popular gun safety legislation came up, and Shady JD called him, as Desi called him, so the problem is not actually guns, or if it is, the only thing that we can do is turn our schools, I guess, into fortresses.
But what do we do about the schools? What do we do to protect our kids? And I think the answer is, and I say this not loving the answer, I unfortunately think that we have to increase security in our schools. We have to make the doors lock better. We have to make the doors stronger. We've got to make the windows stronger. And of course, we've got to increase school resource officers, because the idea that we can magically wave a wand and take guns out of the hands of bad guys, it just doesn't fit with recent experience. So we've got to make our schools safer. And I think we've got to have some common sense bipartisan solutions for how to do that.
Now, in response, Tim Walz, a hunter, a longtime National Guardsman, a Second Amendment supporter who previously had an A-plus rating from the NRA before they changed that to an F because he had the temerity to support gun safety measures after the Parkland school shooting, he offered some straight talk in response.
Sometimes it just is the guns. It's just the guns, and there are things that you can do about it. But I do think that this is one, and I think this is a healthy conversation. I think there's a capacity to find solutions on this that work, protect Second Amendment, protect our children. That's our priority.
So, Driftglass, I'm not even sure I have a specific question on this. I'm wondering your thoughts. It seems like we've, you know, been having this same the same arguments, all of them, over guns, healthcare, abortion, kind of everything else, over and over and over for years. Will this one finally change if Harris Waltz win, or are we going to keep going around and around for another 20 years?
They might change. I mean, I have, you know, no confidence the NRA is going to lose its grip on the Republican Party. The Republican Party is going to keep doing their bidding as long as they're a majority anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But I, as I recall, I liked Tim Walz's answer to the question, aren't you reversing yourself on assault weapons? And he's, what made you do that? He said, I sat down with Sandy Hook parents
mm-hmm.
and we talked about our kids and, you know, I changed my mind. And that must have come as a huge relief to people like, oh, you're allowed to do that. Yes. Oh my God, you're allowed to change your mind. And I'm a gun owner. I keep it, you know, kept a shotgun on my truck so I could shoot quail after football practice. That is very Midwestern. That is very much, you know, it's soon to be deer hunting season here. They're holding, you know, Second Amendment sales at Farm and Home right now for ammunition and camo gear.
Mm-hmm.
That's the culture. Mm-hmm. So he fits in very well with the culture. And then he says, but there's certain things we just can't keep lying about. And one of them is it's the guns. Sometimes it's just the guns. J.D. Vance's argument is essentially laws don't work. Why even have laws? You know, you make a law, people violate it. What are you going to do? Well, you can take their guns away from them. I don't know. you put them in jail if they do it again. We seem to have laws for everything else that's potentially lethal. Why not that?
Mm.
So I thought his answer appealed to exactly the demographic that the Democrats are trying to get on board. And I'm one of you guys. I can be trusted. But this is nuts, and it's okay to change your mind on a few things, and this is one of them.
Mm. We have to get out here. Of course, I've got, you know, 10 more issues to ask you guys about that came up in that debate, because there was a lot of stuff that came out. We'll talk about it, of course, in our bonus subscriber only hour after this,
which doesn't exist.
Oh yeah, don't tell them.
Yeah, I should ask for more money.
Damn it, Desi. Anyway, so let me close with this for all of you guys. All of this said, Trump's polling numbers, if you trust them, have seemingly improved in recent days, including in the wake of his and J.D. Vance's, you know, week or two long, utterly false claims and nonsense about legal Haitian migrants in Springfield, Ohio. Both describing them as, quote, illegal, even when they're not, falsely insisting they are stealing and eating people's pets. That, what seemed to me to be an embarrassment, ultimately seems to have helped, not hurt, the Trump-Vance ticket, according to polling, anyway. Let me get both of your, all three of your thoughts about that before we get out, because it seems like the more embarrassing and horrible they are, the better they do, Driftglass.
Well, they do better with the people they do better with. As you know, fact-checking is MAGA code for liberal media conspiracy. So whatever Donald Trump tells them that they want to hear is what they want to hear. There's just a hardcore base of people on the right who are unsalvageably lost to reason forever. And that's just the way it's going to be.
But it's not 45%. Let me press you. It's not just the people on the right, because, you know, after the president, the first debate with Harris and Trump, her numbers were going up until he sort of seized the narrative with this whole eating the dogs thing. And then I don't want to say that numbers reversed, but, you know, they certainly stopped rising for Harris and did rise a bit for Donald Trump.
Well, and that's that little sliver in the middle who can't make up their mind whether they want to eat arsenic or apple pie. They're just very lost, and they tend to float back and forth between positions because they're the last, you know, hook up at the bar. And I don't know who I want to go home with. What are you going to do for me? What's, you know, and it's ridiculous and it's insane, and the Electoral College is to blame and the media is to blame, but that's the reality we live in. So I admire the Democratic strategy of sticking to their plan, going, we have to get these folks on board. So we're going to line up Trump's former cabinet members. We're going to line up as many Republicans as we can. We're going to get Dick Cheney to endorse us, all of which I hate.
I know you do.
But that's what you have to do, get that tiny fraction of idiots on board for one election and do it, because that's what the stakes are now.
Heather, it kind of feels to me like Donald Trump sees the narrative. You know, we were seeing nothing but Kamala Harris for a while. Then they come out with eating the dogs. And then we, once again, all we were doing was seeing J.D. Vance and Donald Trump on the TV machine. It kind of seems like America, or at least, you know, some of the voters out there, are going to vote for sort of the last person they see on their TV. I don't know.
That's always a possibility. And in fact, you know, I mean, we know in 2016 that one of the reasons that there was an up and down in the polling that was going in the last couple of months, depending on which crisis hit. You know, for Trump, it was the Access Hollywood thing. Mm-hmm. Then Hillary Clinton had the James Comey letter, and she didn't have time to recover her points in that. So it happened a little bit too late. So, yeah, these things do make a difference. But I would also argue there's something else going on, because I've been reading a lot about polling. In fact, there's a great article in The American Prospect by Rick Perlstein that he put out about the history of polling. And you'll be shocked to read it if you read it. You will not realize just how messed up polling has always been. Mm. And there's a reason for it. And it's because everybody's fighting the last war. And they have no choice. There's no other war to fight. They don't know what war they're fighting right now. So it's, you know, it's in the dark. There is something that's happening, though, in the polling averages, which is what we're all watching now, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you don't look at individual polls anymore. Right. There are a lot of right-wing affiliated polls that are dropping their polls into these averages. And they did it in 2022. And it's why there was this belief that there was this big red wave, because the averages were being actually manipulated a bit by these right-wing polls that were showing a movement towards the Republicans. So I'm not saying that that's necessarily the reason or what has spurred this, but other people are noticing this. It isn't just me. That are saying that this is happening again, and just be wary. Just be wary and take it all with a grain of salt.
Okay, I think the final thing that I want to say just is that J.D. Vance proved that he will not do anything to stop Trump's worst actions. Right. And that's really dangerous.
We have got to get out, guys. Thank you very much for an excellent conversation. Heather Digby Parton can be found, of course, at Salon.com and on her own blog, digbysblog.net. You can also find her on the site still known as Twitter at Digby56. And you can find our friend Driftglass also on the Twitters, where he is Mr._Electrico. You can check out his blog at driftglass.blogspot.com and, of course, download his weekly Professional Left podcast at proleftpod.com. Thanks as well to our producer, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. Supported by those of you kind enough to hit a donate button or go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves and to get that free subscriber-only bonus hour. That doesn't exist. Anyway, hey, thanks, guys. Got to get out. You can drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. See you there. Till we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.